on the Democratization of Money is based on a lecture which described the application of democratic principles in Australia. Although the material is wholly Australian, these principles would apply as well to any other Western country. Your supervisor will help you to relate the principles to other nations. You may well ask, how on earth can money be democratized? First of all, we have to understand something about what democracy is. If you were to ask what democracy is, most people would say that it had something to do with the people having the right to vote. That's true, of course. But we should remember Joseph Stalin's running the Soviet Union in the 1930s, where everybody voted, and at least 98.5% voted for Stalin's nominees. It's just that there didn't happen to be any other candidates, and if you didn't vote for his nominees, you may well have been shot. Stalin called this democracy. How absurd. Democracy is more than just having the right to vote. A truly democratic vote is one in which each person holds an effective sanction which ensures a just share of power and influence in decision-making. Voting is a method of decision-making. A vote gives the individual a choice in this mechanism for decision-making. Another common definition of democracy is that it is a majority rule. Dicey, the 20th century constitutional authority, maintained that if a parliament passed a law that all blue-eyed children should be put to death at birth, then that would be a perfectly legal piece of legislation. Legal or not, it is most certainly not democracy. Democracy, with its sanction for each person to have his or her say in power, involves respecting minorities and respecting the right of minorities to have their just say also. Decisions in democracies must be made by individuals, as individuals, and not by mobs who are harangued by demagogues into an emotional yea or nay. Democracy is not mobocracy. Democracy in the West was centred around lawful authority. The British developed democracy around a constitutional monarchy. In Australia, this continues to be the case, where the monarch promises in the coronation oath to be loyal to God, to the people, and to the will of the people. It does not involve any options to depreciate the rights, lives, or property of minority groups. Democracy is confined in some ways. It is confined in that it must only be applied where the decisions are actually made by those people who are affected by that issue. I don't particularly want my neighbour making decisions about matters that are strictly my business, and he doesn't want me making decisions about his household either. And so, in a way, democracy is a mechanism whereby my neighbour and myself associate together and agree that we shall limit, through government, the control each has over the other. The idea is to eliminate the possibility of other people interfering in that business which is properly that of the family or the individual. Democracy is also limited in that it can only apply to policies. With democracy, we outline the results we want and we can give them priorities. We can say, yes, the foremost thing we want in this community is better roads. But it cannot go beyond that. We cannot tell the engineers and the surveyors and all the technical people how to do their job. They must be personally responsible. In a true democracy, the individuals in that community make the decision that, yes, it will be roads that we will be constructing and not perhaps pyramids or parliament houses. Democracy is all about establishing just relationships between individuals and society. Democracy is not any one simple device, but a relationship. Simple mechanisms are needed to carry it, though those mechanisms will not be foolproof. However, once we have a mechanism, and in this case the mechanism of political democracy is the vote, we must then make a decision as to whom that mechanism belongs. Whose is the vote? The early English approach was that to have the right to vote, you had to be over 21, you had to be a male, and you had to have very substantial property. Centuries later, the vote was extended to women. One of Australia's best-known novelists, Neville Shute, made his contribution in his novel In the Wet. In this story, an old Australian lay on his deathbed, hallucinating about the future of his country. He saw the need for a tremendous increase in the responsibility of voters. And he made a novel suggestion. He suggested that everybody should get one basic vote, and then on top of that, there would be other votes that could be given. Those who were raising a family, or who had raised a family, would be given a second vote, because that indicated they had extra responsibilities in the community. Those people who owned their own homes, maintained their own homes, or were paying one off, would get a third vote for the same reason. Those who served in a military way to defend their country, or gave notable service to a charity, may get others. And finally, very occasionally, a particular person may get a total of seven votes, the last one in his proposal being conferred by the community itself as an honour to those who had given greater service. I'm not raising this proposal in order to advocate it, but simply to indicate that there is a decision there that has to be made. The current Australian decision is that every Australian, 18 years of age or over, will get one vote and only one vote. On balance, I think that's a good decision and probably the best one. However, a decision has to be made, and that decision must reflect, and always will reflect, what is perceived to be a just relationship within the community. If we went back to the early English experience, where only the substantial landowners had a vote, that would be perceived now, quite correctly, as a gross injustice. But nevertheless, in its initial development, it was a tremendous advancement for democracy because it began to expand responsibility, and it began to institute the concept of government with the consent of the governed. I would like to make another proposal, just to see how you react to it. If you have ever taken a number of children on a bushwalk and picnic, you will notice that some of them will pick wildflowers, and others will gather dry reeds and make little baskets and collect things. When it comes time to go home, you may find a little reed basket with some wildflowers in it, and you pick it up and say, "Whose is this?" And they all say, "Oh, that's Mary's." "Is this yours, Mary?" "Yes, that's mine. We all agree it's Mary's." "Why is it Mary's?" "Because she made it." This is natural justice in operation. Now let's face it, when we go to elect a government, who makes the ballot papers? The electoral office. If it wasn't for the electoral office, there would be no votes. So the electoral office makes all the votes. They create all the ballots. So here is another proposal for you. The electoral office should cast all the votes. But of course, voters are not like goods, are they? A vote really is an invention out of our own minds. It is simply a concept developed into a mechanism to indicate choice, whereby a certain people can make a choice. A vote is different, isn't it, from the paper on which it is written? They are different things. One is a piece of paper, a mechanism. The other is a choice by a free person acting in his own interests. Now, I hope you agree that this proposal to give the electoral office all the votes is ridiculous. Keep this matter of the electoral office in mind, because I'm going to draw you back to it a little later. Dr. Thomas Satz, a well-known though controversial psychologist, observed that there are only three sanctions in human society. The first one, he said, was the gun or compulsion. Raw, naked compulsion. Naked political power. What is the answer to that sanction? How are we to control it in order to have democracy? The vote. The second sanction is the power of inducement. In most circumstances, inducement is more powerful than compulsion, because all men are universally open to inducement, and it doesn't create as many enemies. We have a mechanism of inducement, and it's called the Australian dollar. The third and final sanction he described as the word. The word can change people's minds. Words can enthuse us, convince us, depress or encourage us, inspire, despair, or entertain us. The word is a sanction which can be exercised over human minds. Well then, who owns words? We do have a protective device called copyright, but that only applies where words are put together in a particular and original sequence. There have been people who have invented words. George Bernard Shaw invented a word. It is the longest word in the English language. It is anti-disestablishmentarianism. Now, don't ask me what it means, but if you like it, you can use it. Words, you see, are free. They are a tremendous mechanism for communication, and they represent a real sanction in human society. But, of course, education in the use of words is not free, and society has recognized that. Someone must pay, someone must teach, and someone must provide the written word and other facilities. So we have developed a concept of the right of every child to a free education, or what's called a free education, so that all individuals, since they are exercising a vote, can be properly informed and therefore can properly exercise that responsibility. Thus we instruct our children so that they shall know words and be able to spell, to write, pronounce and use them correctly. Free education is an integral part of democracy in a free society. Everyone who votes obviously needs access to information. It is interesting that the vote followed literacy. It did not precede it. In early English society, where fewer people read, fewer people voted. Once everyone was able to command the sanction of the word, then the moral persuasion that these people were responsible and had access to knowledge could not be denied, and so the vote was extended universally. Enormous care, effort, and sacrifice have been given through the ages and applied to ensuring that the sanction of the vote and the sanction of the word were available without charge to all free people. The vote controlled political power. Through political power, it also controlled all of those other powers, like monopoly industry, or corruption in the police force, or organized crime, and much else. The vote was also used to make sure that every individual could make up his own mind, through being freely informed with a free press in a highly literate society. The sanctions of the vote and the word were both, in their own way, democratized, and the one buttressed the other. However, we have been rather neglectful in the instance of that other sanction, the sanction of the dollar, the inducement that is money. Well, what is money? Let's define it. Money is anything, no matter of what it is made or why people want it, which everybody will accept in exchange for their disposable goods and services. When you ask most people what money is, they take out their wallets and wave a piece of paper and say, "That's money." That's quite right. That is money. But if you went to Japan and you purchased something and they asked you for some money and you took that out and offered it, they would say, "What's this? It's only an old, second-hand, crumpled piece of paper with a lot of squiggly, unintelligible writing on it." So what makes money, money? The answer is that belief is the thing that gives money its value. Only the fact that we believe that it's money makes it so. Money is a product of faith. Is rum money? We don't believe so. However, if you went back to the first 30 years of Sydney, the first city in Australia, over 90% of all transactions were reckoned in terms of rum. Rum was the first money form developed in this country. Even today, there are people who think that drinking rum is a waste of money. Of course, there are those who believe it's a good investment. If you want to look at some of the unusual money forms, you can have a lot of fun. Wampum shells were used on the North American continent by the Indians. The early English used notched sticks. The people of Santa Cruz Islands used woodpecker scalps. In northern Siberia, it was reindeer. And in the very isolated community on Easter Island that had practically no domestic animals, it was dead rats, a gastronomic delight. Almost everything other than the kitchen sink has been used as money. In the Polynesian Islands, for instance, there was a money form there where an individual coin weighed over 50 tons and was made of stone. At least thieves could never literally lift them. The Greek city-states, to whom we owe so much in the development of Western civilization, had one of the most efficient military cultures in the world. In the city-state of Sparta, they actually discouraged any form of commerce because they had plenty of slaves to do all the economic activity. They made their coins out of iron. They weighed over 100 weight each. You can imagine the difficulty those poor Spartans had in spending even a penny. Money developed first in its very early beginnings through the use of a commodity. The early Egyptians used grain. In medieval Europe, they used cattle. And we speak today of pecuniary matters because the Latin word for cattle is picus. We still talk of salaries, and that comes from the Roman use of salt, the Latin word for which is solarium, as a commodity to pay wages. And of course, there was the commodity of gold. However, in many instances, for convenience, we moved on from using the commodity itself to use a token to represent the commodity. And so in medieval Europe, leather discs were developed with a particular cattle brand on them. The cattleman took his picus into the marketplace in the form of a leather disc. It was traded as money, and eventually when somebody wanted a bullock, they brought a disc back to the cattleman and took delivery of the beast. Of course, we developed tokens for gold or banknotes, and until 1931 in Australia, all Australian notes promised to pay the bearer of the note upon demand 1 sovereign in gold. The official government of Canada used playing cards, ordinary playing cards. The British governor found himself in difficulties because he had a lot of troops to pay, and there was simply not enough specie or coin or any form of money in Canada to pay them, and the troops were very restless. So he requisitioned the playing cards. The governor personally signed some of the denominations, so for instance an ace might be worth $1,000 and a king $500 and so on, and it worked. And at times it was reused when specie was short for over 100 years. And lastly, of course, we arrive at this mysterious thing called credit. For instance, bank credit. Bank credit sounds rather foreboding, but it is not really any different to butcher's credit. If, as a cattleman, I supplied a beast to the butcher and he offered to give me a credit in his books for, say, $500, and I had an account there and I bought my beef from him, then I might accept that. Instead of using other money, I may on occasions ask the butcher to transfer some of the credit I had in my account to some other person who also had an account with him. When all parties agreed, payments were sometimes made in this way. When that was agreed upon as a perfectly acceptable mechanism, nothing changed hands, except in those greasy old record books which butchers used in communities where hundreds of farming families had 30-day accounts with the local butcher. Bank credit began with the bank storing gold. The banks gave receipts as a token in exchange for the gold. That token could either be spent or returned to the banker and the gold procured in that way. However, finally, the bank may open an account for you and any gold or receipts for gold you deposited would be credited to your account. You could transfer it to somebody else if you so desired. It was a very convenient mechanism for making payments. The bank could also supply you with a book of standard letters that you just filled out and signed. These are now called checks. So, finally, man arrived at the ultimate form of money. The enumerated abstraction. Today, most of our money exists simply as records in computers. It has no other physical representation at all. It has numbers, it has no set form, though it can be printed out onto a piece of paper. It is not a token, it is just a record. What gives it value is that we confer value upon it. We believe, for some reason, that a deposit in the bank is money, and so does everybody else, and so we are able to use it as money. With a political vote, it doesn't really matter what form that vote takes. It may just be a noise. And often in Parliament House, major motions are carried on the voices aye, or nay. That's a vote. It's just needed to be an indication of choice. It may be conveyed as an action. Those for, raise your right hands. Those against? Or it may be a mark on a ballot paper. Its value, of course, is elsewhere. A political vote's value is in the choice that it grants you. Well, what about your money? Does it really matter whether your money is a coin or a note, or credit in the computer at the bank. Its value is elsewhere. It resides in the inherent choice that it gives you over goods and services, not in any intrinsic value. Now, we know what we do with political votes, don't we? We hand them out. Everyone gets one each, and there is no charge. But do we hand out the money vote? Nobody has given me any, and I don't think you have received any. Some people say, but look, money is different from votes. But is it? Just suppose you are lucky enough to have a dollar. You go down to the corner store and walk in and say to a perfect stranger, "Can I have a pie and peas, please?" He goes and gets it. And when he comes back, you say, "Have you got any hot sauce?" He says, "I've got tomato sauce or soy sauce." He is deferring to you, isn't he? In fact, he is acting like your servant and treating you like his master. And he's never seen you before in his life. Why is he doing that? Because you've got a sanction, because you have a dollar, because you have ordered a pie. He has been given an order. You could, of course, have elected to have two sausage rolls instead, or a cup of chips, or some soda squash. You could have elected any of many things, but you ordered a pie. Industry needs orders, and it responds to orders. The money vote is a mechanism to control and direct industry, in the same way that a political vote is a mechanism to control and direct government. When we use our political vote, we can choose, for our sins, to have a Labour representative, or a National, or a Liberal, or perhaps some other candidate. Somebody says it is a bit like marriage. You takes your pick, and you pays your price. The price of a pie is a dollar, and if it's a bad pie, perhaps pay also with indigestion. You see, the ballot paper and the money paper are simply mechanisms. Both are sanctions, real sanctions, and both are abstractions, organized to indicate choice. Both are man-made. Neither the political vote nor the money vote grows on trees. The political vote is a mechanism to give orders in politics, and a dollar is a mechanism to give orders in industry. Who owns the political vote? We all get one each. We have already decided that. We may change our minds and have something else, but that's our decision. In a similar way, we ask, who owns the dollar? Well, with commodity money, you see, it was quite simple. In the days when everybody decided that it was gold and only gold that was the money, then to get some money you had to go out into them there hills with a pick, and you had to dig an enormous great hole in the ground, and you had to dig out tons and tons of rock. Then you had to get a sledgehammer, and you had to beat the rock day after day until it was all pounded up. Then you sifted it out and got the heaviest particles, and then you had to heat it up to a few hundred degrees and then pour it into a mould. And at the end of all that, if somebody had come along and said, "Look, what you have there is a kind of vote, and you should share it with everybody," the response would be a miners' revolt, or what we in Australia call a Eureka Stockade. You see, it wasn't a just relationship, was it? Not if it was that difficult to create money. Well, what about when money is simply printed on paper or typed into computers? The cost of production is almost zero. The difference between telling a computer to create a loan account with $1 and a loan account with $1 billion is 9 times 0, and the time it takes to type it. When a government goes to a trading bank for a loan of $1 billion, lots of discussions take place. After that, all that really happens is that a very junior girl brings an account onto a computer display, types in a few details about the number of the account, the name, and who is responsible for writing the checks, and then simply types in credit limit $1 billion. It's a bit like going to your butcher and saying, "Look, butcher, I'm a bit short. Would you lend me $1 million? He might say, "Okay, sounds all right. You'll have to pay the going rate of interest, 10, 15, 20% perhaps. I am not responsible for setting interest rates, mind you. It's the government which does that. So I'll give you a credit in your little account at my butcher shop as long as you give me $200,000 a year. Well, that's the going rate, so that sounds okay. Or does it? Admittedly, the butcher has to wipe his greasy fingers on his apron. He has to take his pencil out of his pocket, turn to your account and write across the top, "Overdraw to the limit of $1 million. Later, when your $1 million check is presented, He must debit you $1 million and credit the payee. The butcher is entitled to charge for this service, but to charge $100,000 to $200,000 per annum for eternity, or until you can get someone else with a credit of $1 million in their account at the butcher shop to transfer it to you, seems to me to be excessive. Of course, in the butcher's case, he has to bear a risk. It is always possible that the person you paid and who now has a $1 million credit may walk into the butcher shop and say, "Could I have $1 million worth of sausages, please?" Since on any one day there are not that many sausages in the southern hemisphere, the butcher is then in default. All his assets are then seized and sold to help meet his obligations. Of course, banks don't have this difficulty. If you have a $10,000 deposit in your bank and you go in and say, "I've decided to spend the $10,000, could I have a used car, please?" they would tell you to see the garage proprietor. Perhaps you would then say, "Would you please extend my house by one room?" They would tell you to see the local carpenter. No matter what you ask for, the bank can't and won't supply. While our deposits in banks are recorded in the banker's books as liabilities, they are really a phony liability. All a bank will do to meet its liabilities is undertake to transfer your deposit, the bank's liability, to the bank account of someone else. That someone else will be the one who actually provides real value for it with goods and services. All a bank will do to honour its liability to you as a depositor is to give you pretty bits of paper, which they buy at much less than face value from the Commonwealth Government, which often makes a loss, or transfer your deposit record to another account upon your direction. What a bank calls a $1 million liability is generally met at the cost of about 20 cents by transferring the deposit to another account when directed to do so with a check. Who's making money and how much? Let's look at some official figures. The figures I'm using, and there are not many of them, only two sets of statistics are used, come from the Reserve Bank of Australia's Bulletin of September 1989. You can't get them more authoritative than that. If on the 30th of June 1988 you counted up all the Australian dollars in existence, you would find there were 130 billion of them. Somebody actually did it, and that's the answer. And exactly 1 year later, the 30th of June 1989, they did it again, and this time there were 164.8 billion of them. There were an extra 34.8 billion Australian dollars in existence. Where did they come from? They were simply created in the banking system by the normal mechanism of extending extra credit to people. Well, that's okay. We need a mechanism. It's a very simple, efficient, well-organized system. I agree that we should license or charter banks or some institution to do that, to create and keep the records of our money. But should they then keep all the proceeds? Did you know that they do now keep all the proceeds? From today, whatever day it is, until this day next year, there will be, and this is drastically understating it, more than an additional 34 billion Australian dollars created. That's more than $2,000 for every one of the 17 million Australians alive. Thinking of it in households of an average of four people, that is more than $8,000 for every Australian household. When next you take a drive through the country or out in the country, every time you see a home, say to yourself, "Aha, another $8,000 was created just this last financial year." But the family doesn't get them. Our household, if we're four people, didn't get that $8,000. We didn't even get one. We know if the electoral office created all the political votes and then decided to keep them, we'd be furious. But we have another entity, the banks, which are a mechanism to create the money vote, the sanction of economic choice, and they keep them all. Is that a just relationship? After all, this is what democracy is about, a just relationship. Is this bank robbery? Well, if you doubt whether they kept the money or not, We've only got to refer back again to the same one document, the Reserve Bank Bulletin of September 1989. This is the last set of statistics I'll use. In that same financial year, at 30th of June 1988, trading banks' assets and saving banks' assets were $145.8 and $72 billion respectively, or $217.8 billion together. At the end of the financial year, in June 1989, they were $181.9 and $86 billion respectively, for a total of $267.9 billion. Bank assets in 1 year increased by $50.1 billion. That is the Reserve Bank telling us that in its September 1989 bulletin. Loans increased by over $50 billion. It is interesting, isn't it, that our deposits only increased by $34.8 billion, as we have already discovered in this talk. The reason for this discrepancy was in part servicing overseas debt and import costs. Well, of course, the banks are embarrassed, but we only hear about them being embarrassed about profits. The ANZ Bank in 1989 was very embarrassed because they made a record profit of $350 million. And if the National Bank profit, I think from memory, was $140 million, Westpac was more, over $500 million. Total trading bank profits for that financial year were over the billion-dollar mark. Now, if this wasn't a seminar about money, but it was one of those public entertainment quiz shows, and I said, look, you're winners. Here's $1 billion. It really is, in notes or whatever, $1 billion. And over here there is a box. In the box you've got $50.1 billion worth of cash assets. What do you want, ladies and gentlemen? Do you want the money or do you want the box? You see, the money in the box, bank asset growth in that year, amounts to $2,947 per citizen and to over $11,788 for every Australian household. Some 11,788 money votes were created for every household in this country. That's assuming there were four people on average in them. That's $226.69 per week per household. There is a free choice. We can choose that all newly created dollars can be put into bank assets. We can say, yes, that's a great way to organize them. Or we can say, well, no, we'll give them all to the government. And then we can either work for the government or give them goods and services, and perhaps we can get some. It might be better, perhaps, than going into debt to the banks, which is the only way you can get them at the moment. But there is another choice. The third choice is that we can decide that those money votes belong to the people. This is a radical view, of course. I use the word radical in the orthodox way here, as one which is at variance with the bank's self-interest. Often people say, well, look, taking $50 billion away from bank assets growth in the next year, isn't that robbing the banks? We know that there is going to be something like $3,000 for every living Australian created in the next year. How can those money votes or dollars belong to the banks? They don't exist. The money that is going to be created in the next year, it doesn't yet exist. Can you own something that doesn't exist? That's impossible. The old money which was created yesterday and which somebody now has, that's a very different matter. But let's just look to the future for the moment. Nobody owns those now uncreated dollar votes. And the option is open to make a decision in a democracy about who shall own them. Company law, of course, has long since solved this question. If we regarded Australia Unlimited as a type of company, then the government would be seen as the board of directors, and we citizens would be the shareholders. We have already decided politically we are all shareholders in Australia, and we are all to get one share at par or one vote. The citizens already use the vote to elect the board of directors, that is, the government. Now suppose that our company, so organized, issued additional scrip, shares or stocks. And the board of directors said, well, look, that's great. We're the government, so we parliamentarians will take the lot of it, all $50 billion worth. It's not on. Any company director that did that would be before the court for fraud in a flash. But there is another point of view, and it has its supporters. They say that when a company issues additional shares, the people who work in the share registry should be able to put them all in their briefcases and go home and say, Mum, we're rich. There is not one company in the world that has ever accepted that as a just relationship. The other option, and I favour it, is that the shareholders own all the script created. All company law, all over the world, supports that point of view. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, this is definitely a case of bank robbery. The banks are robbing the shareholders, the citizens, and there is no doubt of it. Next question. Is it inflationary? Well, suppose the government got it all. Would that be inflationary? Maybe. If we got it all, would that be inflationary? Maybe. But supposing that the banks got it all, you've noticed, haven't you? You've noticed over the last umpteen years that inflation is what we've had. It isn't a matter of who gets the money, but firstly of how much, and secondly of how. If, for example, it's to be 157% interest, inflation will be higher per dollar issued. I'm going to put a simple proposal. Every Australian citizen should get an equal share in the post, plus the share due for any dependent children. I'm not interested in interfering in the technical considerations of how much is the best amount to issue. It's beyond the question of whether it's $50 or 50 cents or $50 billion. The question is, whose are those money votes? Just how are they distributed? To whom and on what terms? That is the question. Of course, citizens do get a lot of the dollar increase now, but they get them in the form of increased consumer debt. Industry gets a share of those additional dollars also, and you can call that industrial debt or company debt. And government, of course, gets a lion's share, and we call that public debt or the national debt. When government borrows, it means we will be burdened with more taxes to meet the repayments. When industry gets it, it means higher prices than would otherwise be the case to service those debts. And of course, when we get it as consumer debt, it means that we shall certainly be needing more wages next year to be able to meet those repayments, plus the increased taxes and prices. However, if we are going to decide that all newly created dollars belong to individuals as a right of birth, then we will be giving them to ourselves and without charges for redemption and interest. Then, if we are giving all new money to ourselves and we are not increasing people's costs, and we certainly aren't, and if the citizens have this money rather than the banks, and we are not increasing the money supply more than it would otherwise be increased, then no, it is not inflationary. True democracy emerges as we democratize all three sanctions, which are the political sanction, the financial sanction, and the sanction of the word. First question, are you proposing that instead of the banks claiming the money increases and then making them available to the citizens as loans, that the citizens will get those money increases direct? Essentially, that is correct. But that doesn't mean the funds aren't there. It simply means that they are in our hands and we own them. And we can invest them, if you like, in building societies as we do now, or investment trusts, or agriculture, or small business, whatever we choose. Industry and government would have to go to the public, not the banks, for those funds. So what? Where is the problem? The government and the industry would be in debt to us, not us to the banks. And that sounds okay to me. Another question. Are the asset increases which the banks have quoted net increases? No, they are not. When we deposit the proceeds of bank loans back into the bank, then that deposit is accounted as a bank liability. But really, what sort of a liability is it? To honour that liability, the bank doesn't have to come up with goods and services and deliver them to you just because you've got a deposit there. All they have to do is agree to transfer that bank account to somebody else who is going to meet the real requirement, which is to give you the goods and services which you want. Then what about the banks? Would they still be able to make loans? If all new money creations were distributed to citizens as a birthright, the final answer is no. This is so because when a bank loans you money and you spend it, then that creates an increased bank deposit for the person you pay. Thus, as bank deposits are money, they would be creating money. Non-bank financiers, such as building societies, investment trusts, and the stock exchange, would not be affected. Indeed, they would have more funds. We would borrow from them in the normal way, only more so. Investments of the national dividend funds will be the responsibility of the citizens who own them, who may delegate it to many types of investment institutions, for instance building societies, insurance companies, and no doubt investment trusts, many of them subsidiaries of banks. However, the ownership of money will be the citizens, and it will be distributed free, not as a debt, and therefore the citizen will be the master. Then what about bank profits? Certainly banks need profits, and if we want efficient, well-organized service, we shall certainly have to pay for it. Bank charges, other than interest, and there are a lot of them, will remain. Normally, the difference between the interest financial institutions pay and charge is about 2% per annum. They have to provide for some losses to borrowers becoming bankrupt, and there is an enormous infrastructure to process loans, check who has sufficient assets and income to be risk-worthy, and to constantly monitor business risks. All this would stop. A charge of about 0.5% on deposit would maintain bank profits, even increase them. Am I saying that in the end, banks may ultimately welcome a democratized money system? Yes, even that. Initially, they will be very nervous, and they will not readily lay down their power to allocate resources through loans. However, as profits would not be affected, but perhaps even increased, the shareholders whose interests are in profits can definitely be brought on side. Nobody's self-interest is opposed to democratizing money. The reason we don't have this system now is that too few have dared to conceive or understand it and then explain it to their fellows. When we understand it, we'll want it. When we want it, we'll get it. So what about the machinery for a democratic money system? A brief outline will suffice to establish one viable option. In Australia, we have an arbitration court to handle the rather complex matter of wage and salary levels. A similar approach could be used to determine our money policy. A special fiscal arbitration court might be constitutionally established and empowered to determine what the money supply expansion or contraction would be in any period of time, probably quarterly. It would need to be able to take evidence from whomever it chose, to employ whatever expertise it needed, and it would need to be well funded. Other desirable conditions would be as follows. 1. It should always meet in open session. 2. It would be required to accept and consider written submissions from any Australian citizen. 3. It would have to give all findings with supportive reasoning in writing and make them publicly available. 2 other constitutional powers would be required. A. The power to direct the Reserve Bank to create and place in a special account the money supply increase as determined by the court and to disperse these funds equally to all persons of Australian citizenship. And B, the power to impose unlimited fines, if necessary, to fulfil its constitutional obligation to prohibit any bank or banks from creating any money whatever, other than in the first power just described. The three main economic effects would be, 1, the annual increase in indebtedness would stop, thereby stopping the cost increases occasioned by extra debt servicing and limiting this major aspect of inflation. 2. credit would be placed in the hands of citizens with which to cancel out remaining personal, industrial, and national debt. 3. By having the decision as to the optimum level of money supply made by a disinterested party, better decisions will result. Banks which claim ownership of additional money created, or governments which get to spend it on vote-catching by deficit borrowing, are not disinterested parties. Would this proposal have to be totally adopted to work? No. We might decide initially to only distribute one-third of the money creations to citizens. We might have slightly different mechanisms. However, nothing is possible until we confront the question, to whom do money creations belong? And answer it with the simple reply, the citizens. Another common question is, won't industry and commercial interests oppose such a proposal? Initially, until it is understood, any response is possible. However, ask yourselves, if you were trying to sell, say, insurance, or motor cars, or any product at all, would it help if every household had just received maybe $2,000 in the mail? Industry and non-bank financial houses' interests, since they don't create money, are at one with their clients. Anything that helps us to buy their products helps them. Of course, a vital question is, does this proposal really democratize money? Well, supposing your family gets $12,000 in the post. If you decide to spend that money, you might order an additional room on the house, because perhaps the family is growing. You might elect to buy a second, rather beat-up used car for a student family member. You might decide that all the family will have a better education. The important question is, who is giving the orders? The answer is that it is the citizen. And isn't that democracy? I think so. What if we decide to invest it? Perhaps in small business or in the farm. You decide to invest it in your own business. If you were investing that $12,000 in high technology, agriculture, heavy industry or basket weaving, you, the citizen, would be making the decisions. And that is democracy. It is democracy to have citizens responsibly making the real decisions about investment in this country. The social impact will be as well computed by you as by myself. It would obviously take the pressure off all families. This would translate in as many different ways as there are families. Some would reduce their debts and live more relaxed lives. Some wives would be able to stop working. Instead of working for many years to pay off the home before having children, this would often come sooner, and at least some families would be larger. A more relaxed society should be a less grasping society, a more generous and harmonious one. There would be a little more time to do the things we really want to do, more time for each other.